are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In 2010, a brave whistleblower alerted the police to Dr. Stan Lee's corrupt pain management clinic in Queens, New York. Lee spent years supplying more than 70 patients a day with oxycodone and trading prescriptions for cash. Emergency room doctors, psychiatrists, and desperate family members warned him that his patients were at risk of death, but he would not stop. In Bad Medicine, former prosecutor Charlotte Bismuth meticulously recounts the jaw-dropping details of this criminal case that would span 4 years, culminating in a landmark trial. As a new assistant district attorney and single mother, Bismuth worked tirelessly with her team to bring Dr. Lee to justice. Bad Medicine is a chilling story of corruption and greed, and an important look at the role individual doctors play in America's opioid epidemic. The book that we're featuring this evening is Bad Medicine, Catching New York's Deadliest Pill Pusher, with my special guest, author and former prosecutor, Charlotte Bismuth. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Charlotte Bismuth.
Thank you so much for having me, Dan. I'm really thrilled. I wish I'd known your podcast when I was younger and didn't know any other true crime fans. Thank you.
There we go. Great. Thank you. Thank you so much for this. This is an extraordinary and remarkable story. And let's get right to this. Tell us where you were professionally in your career in November 2010 before we talk about the fateful event, which occurred at work December 1st, 2010.
I was an attorney. I had been admitted to the bar for just over 6 years, I believe, at the time. I'd started my career at the law firm of Debevoise and Plimpton, and then moved after about 4.5 years to the DA's office, where I began in the appeals unit. As an appellate attorney, I defended convictions before the Appellate Division First Department, which involved a lot of brief writing, but luckily also many arguments in front of a panel of judges. So in June of 2010, I had just requested and received a transfer or secondment, technically, to the Office of the Special Narcotics Prosecutor, which is a unique entity that takes ADAs from all 5 boroughs of New York City and has jurisdiction over all felony narcotics crimes within the 5 boroughs. So it allows for a much more rapid and coordinated prosecution of high-level narcotics cases, some of which involve international cartels.
Right. Now, you suffered from a state of privileged innocence, but you had just taken on your first pill case involving a supermodel and forged prescription and Vicodin. Just tell us where you were in terms of what you believed is your state of privileged innocence at this time.
Well, I think that supermodel case is a great example. She was a woman who had fallen into a Vicodin addiction, who had stolen prescriptions from 2 physicians, forged them, and then submitted them to pharmacies across the city. Now, you know, we prosecuted her to the full extent for the theft and forgery of those prescriptions, and she was admitted into a diversion program. But what I recall is that I attributed to her much more agency and bad intent then I think would have been medically appropriate to do so. And, you know, we supported her application for a diversion program, but it was, you know, very tempting, I think, to think to when an individual who is in diversion relapses, to think that some time in prison will correct that the situation or send some sort of a message.
Right.
And I wish that I had known then what I know now.
Right.
Not to say that I would do anything perfectly now, but I think understanding is an education is really important.
Absolutely. Let's talk about this fateful event that happens December 1st, 2010. You're working late. You go to the ladies' room and you pass by your bureau chief's office. He's also, they're also, pardon me, working late. What happens? What does she say to you?
Well, it was, I remember that it was very quiet in the office. Our offices were extremely busy during the day, especially because we had undercovers coming through and people were constantly, you know, yelling, clear the halls, UC, clear the halls. So I was walking down the hall. My boss's office light was on. She called me into her office and she had one of those tiny little post-it notes, you know, the absolute smallest format that you can get.
Right.
And she said, we got a call from the NYPD. Can you look into it? And I looked at the post-it. It had a detective's name on it, his phone number, but it also had the name of a doctor, Dr. Lee, and part of an address, 47th Road in Queens. And I would add that part of my state of privileged innocence, and I think, you know, the one that was to be shattered most completely was I did not think of doctors as criminals or as having the potential to be criminals with respect to their patients. Obviously, we've heard one-off horror stories about sexual abuse or things like that. But it, to me, a complaint that involved, as this one did, a doctor and his prescriptions didn't make sense because that is what doctors do. They write prescriptions. They authorize treatments. They're licensed by the state to do so, and they have our trust to do so. So apparently the complainant told the NYPD there's a doctor in Queens selling prescriptions to kids who don't need them. So, you know, the first step, obviously, there's so many threshold questions. Is the doctor licensed? Is the doctor, you know, practicing within the area for which he's licensed? Is the complainant credible? What age kids are we talking about and what kind of prescriptions? And are we the right office to be answering these questions and looking into this case? And so that's really where we began to make sure, and that, you know, this is really the philosophy of the Manhattan DA's office and Special Narcotics, to make sure that we didn't just jump in with the mindset of criminal prosecution, but to ensure that we, you know, it was the right thing to do so and that we had proper jurisdiction to do so.
Now, there's a complainant, and that's how we led to this tip. And so this tipster is, you've asked for availability to be able to speak to this person, but in the interim, you do a little research. Again, you were a little bit naive, so you did some research about some things. And what did you find about Dr. Lee, but also just in general, some of the things you found?
Well, I would respectfully push back on being naive, only in the sense that I, you know, there's more of a imposter syndrome effect going on there, which is that even though I was in my mid-30s with, you know, degrees from great universities and a good background at a great law firm, I never took for granted the lay of the land, meaning that, you know, I wanted to be an appellate lawyer to make sure that I understood New York State law as opposed to federal law, which I had been practicing. And in this case, I wanted to make sure that I understood before I drew any conclusions about the legitimacy of the doctor's practice, what were the rules that applied to physicians? What were these medications that we were talking about? Where, you know, how they were classified or scheduled, and what were the risks and benefits of these medications? And The other element of it was that, you know, I think I would have done that research in any event because that's just how I operate, but we didn't have access to the tipster. When I asked the NYPD to put me in touch with him, they wouldn't because, and this is sort of a very interesting question that you ask because it reveals how much, you know, we have evolved. At the time, a complainant in a narcotics case for the NYPD was automatically put through this sort of credibility test where they had to go out and make controlled buys for narcotics. But this tipster was not complaining about, you know, a crack dealer or a cartel operation. He was complaining about a doctor. He was also recovering from substance use disorder. The last thing that he wanted to do was to be put back out on the street and tested, you know, have his credibility tested by buying drugs. So we had a long tussle with the NYPD. They were, you know, acting in good faith, but we believe that they were wrong to maintain this requirement. And ultimately, we had to go around them and find the complainant directly, which meant that we ended up running the investigation. This was not a case where, as usual, the NYPD runs the investigation and then turns it over to the DA's office. We owned it from really from day one.
Mm-hmm. What did you find out about Dr. Lee in terms of his ability, his lawful right to write prescriptions, but also in opioid addiction itself?
Yes, excellent point. We identified him as having a pain management practice in Queens, but also as being part of a very well-respected anesthesiology practice at a teaching hospital in New Jersey. And he had been there for a number of years. He was very well-credentialed. And he ran this pain management practice in Queens, so in a different state. He was licensed in both states. He was the DEA registrant, which meant that he was authorized to prescribe controlled substances. And interestingly, on his website, he was also an authorized buprenorphine prescriber, of which there were not that many at the time. And interestingly, in order to become a buprenorphine prescriber, you have to go through an extra level of training, which is called, and obtain another registration, which is called an X registration, like the letter X. And he had done that. But what I thought was peculiar at the time was the notion that a physician could both prescribe medications that were susceptible to cause addiction and also offer treatment for addiction. And I thought, you know, I found that to be so incredibly cynical. And of course, that's where, again, I had so much to learn because, first of all, you know, there's a huge gap right now where physicians who prescribe these medications don't know how to taper their patients off and don't know how to address the problem of a patient with legitimate pain becoming dependent or addicted. And so those doctors, you know, it's a good thing for doctors to have that training to recognize the signs and to be able to help their patients find an exit strategy. And at the same time, what we're seeing now with the Sackler family and Purdue Pharma is the extreme cynicism of both having launched the opioid epidemic with the sale and false marketing of OxyContin and trying to benefit from the massive pool of people suffering from opioid use disorder by marketing treatments for that disorder, the so-called Project Tango from a few years ago. So that's what I feared with Dr. Lee, and little did I know that it was, you know, the plan of a large corporate pharmaceutical company.
Right. You talk about your earliest partner, Joe Hall, and he's an investigator and a veteran New York Police Department homicide detective. And so you had the ambitious job of trying to locate witnesses. You opened the book with one of the people that you found out about, Allie Walton. But tell us a little bit about Joe Hall and your work. And what about the complainant? Do you finally get to meet this person and get to speak to them?
Yes. About Joe Hall, I will say that it was one of the best things that ever happened to me in my life, and one of my greatest honors to not just meet him, but be able to work with him. I had no idea that I was partnered with a legend. As it turned out, Joe Hall had participated in a number of very sensitive investigations, including investigations involving corrupt police officers. So, right. I knew that he had a great reputation, but Joe Hall is also someone who's very humble, who's extremely hardworking, and who, will get along well with anyone who behaves with respect and works, nobody can work as hard as he does, but who works hard. So Joe was assigned to the case when we ran into this roadblock with the NYPD and the complainant. I don't know how he did it, but next thing I know, he asked me if I was ready to meet this young man, whose name in the book is Eddie Valora, just to protect his privacy. And he brought him in. And we were able to have a series of conversation with him. And that's really where, that's a very good test of an early law enforcement / investigative partnership is an interview, but especially a joint interview, because, the hierarchy was very strange in a way. I was the prosecutor, but at the same time, I was a much more junior player in law enforcement than Joe Hall. He was a very experienced investigator, but he also respected my, decision to sort of structure the interview, and he knew that he had to sort of let me frame the interview with the usual cautions and disclaimers. So we very quickly developed this system where, as we were talking, we were both very sensitive to the fact that we didn't want this young man to feel cornered by two interviewers. And we sort of developed these signals where, if Joe wanted to ask a question or I wanted to jump back in, we would allow each other to do that. And as a result, we had a series of very productive conversations with this young man that left us with such a good understanding of the type of practice that he was complaining about, that this was a practice where, prices for pills were put up on the wall in paper, where patients waited outside for hours starting early in the morning and were called with numbered tickets rather than appointments, where people traded pills and prescriptions for cash coming out of the office. And most shockingly to this young man and also to us, where the doctor did not care about the underlying medical conditions of his patients. Our tipster, in fact, had an immune disorder, and one of the things that offended him the most was that Dr. Lee really didn't care about the diagnosis or about the specific kind of pain that he was experiencing.
Now, in your investigation and Joe Hall's investigation, you uncover other people that were involved with Dr. Lee's business and his practice. But there is a certain period of time in this investigation before you are able to get a search warrant. And tell us about this approximately a year of this investigation, how you find people to tell you the stories about this Dr. Lee's behavior.
Well, I will tell you that that year was one of the most difficult that I can recall, because we understood after really just a few weeks or, barely a few months, that we were dealing with a threat to public health, and that there were, men and women who were receiving prescriptions from this doctor that could lead to death. We were progressively beginning to hear about overdoses, both fatal and non-fatal. And I woke up, as I know Joe did, every morning with the fear of hearing about another death. And, and that tells you a lot, because we went very quickly from being concerned of hearing about a death to being concerned of hearing of another one or another one or another one. And it got to the point where, by the time Dr. Lee was arrested in November 2011, we knew of 16 fatal overdoses within his patient population. Now, not all of those had happened, you know, while they were immediately under his care. A couple had happened after the patients left his care, but they were all within a year of having left the clinic. And some of them, like Nicholas Rappold and Joseph Haig, had occurred within just a few days of their last visit. So this was beyond chilling. It was nerve-wracking. It was absolutely terrifying. We felt such a weight. We were so concerned about what might happen under our watch. And then in June 2011, and the nightmare became real. We learned that there had been a shooting in a pharmacy in Medford, Long Island. Four people had been shot in cold blood, the pharmacist, his young assistant, and two customers. And the next morning when I came into the office, my boss, Bridget, walked in as well, as did our criminal analyst, Stephanie Miotto. And the three of us, you know, just knew that we wanted to look through our database of patient records, prescription records, and check whether any of Dr. Lee's patients had ever filled a prescription at that pharmacy. Nobody said it out loud, but we all were concerned that maybe, you know, one of them had been driven to crime. And in fact, we identified one name, actually two names, one current patient, one former patient. They were married to each other. And we ended up forwarding that information to the Suffolk County Police. And the next thing we know, David Laffer was arrested and pled guilty. Mm-hmm. And that was absolutely devastating because, you know, he went into that pharmacy to steal hydrocodone pills, which was the medication that Dr. Lee had been prescribing to him. And he stole 11,000 of them, and he took four lives. So wow. Once that happened, we had to take a very, very hard look at what we knew because, you know, obviously there's a high bar to arrest someone, to get right. a search warrant, to shut down a medical clinic. Again, you're talking about a doctor who writes prescriptions, which he's allowed to do. So Joe and I and Stephanie, that was the extent of the team more or less at the time, really went into overdrive. We added a couple more investigators to the team. And we finally were able to hone in on one patient whose name was Michael Cornetta, who had died of an overdose the year before, I believe in November 2010, and at the age of 37. And his method was to suck on fentanyl patches. So he would get fentanyl patches from prescribed by Dr. Lee, and then he would cut them open and he would aspire the gel. It led to a number of non-fatal overdoses, and unfortunately it led finally to a fatal overdose. And the way that we were able to make a case without having access to Dr. Lee's own patient records is that we received, we sought out medical records from every hospital in the city that we believe Michael Cornetta might have gone to. And we finally, in one of those records, saw a note from a psychiatrist who had not only treated him after an overdose, but who called Dr. Lee, made a note in her file of that call, and told Dr. Lee that she was calling from the emergency room about a patient who had overdosed on fentanyl. And that was a clincher because it showed us that Dr. Lee was put on notice of the risk to his patient. And right. yet what happened? He prescribed fentanyl to him again. And that is how we were able to present evidence to the grand jury. And the grand jury voted a felony charge, well, several felony charges against Dr. Lee, including reckless endangerment in the third degree. I'm sorry, in the second degree. And so we were able to obtain a search warrant and arrest Dr. Lee. And most importantly, we were able to shut down his clinic. So that was in November 2011.
When you went and executed that search warrant, what did you find interesting in terms of the record keeping by Dr. Lee?
So I was waiting at home, unable to sleep, waiting for Joe to call me and tell me that they were in, that they were safe, that everybody was safe. you know, the first thing that surprised us was the tipster had told us about this sheet pasted up somewhere in the office listing Dr. Lee's prices. We, you know, while we found him to be credible, we thought that that would be rather extraordinary and surprising, and yet it was there. It was written in sort of this, you know, ersatz medical jargon, but essentially what it said was, the more pills you want, the more you pay. We only accept cash. The more prescriptions you want, the more you pay. If you're seeing other doctors, you pay more. If you have suicidal ideation, you pay more. And I, you know, it's hard to express what Joe and I felt when we saw that, because, you know, obviously from an investigative standpoint, you really can't wish for anything more than having your suspect, you know, spell out the nature of their exploitation and crime in writing on paper. And at the same time, it just indicated such a dehumanization of his patients and such a level of indifference and such a powerful greed that it became obviously a crucial piece of evidence, but really something that we have never seen again, that they did not see again in any other cases.
Now, you spend the next amount of time gathering up the necessary information and evidence to be able to prosecute this case, and you have a very, very experienced trial partner that's, well, is your partner. Maybe tell us about Peter Koghossian.
I would love to. Peter Koghossian is a lifelong Manhattan assistant district attorney. He's held a number of high-level positions in the office. He is now suffering from ALS. He is hospitalized. His brain is still, you know, one of the most powerful machines that I've ever encountered. And Peter and I had a bit of friction in the beginning because he would sort of, you know, for the first few years of the investigation, he was sort of hovering as an occasional expert / consultant. You know, he was someone that we went to if we had a question about, you know, ethics or strategy or legal research to, you know, he's really the ultimate devil's advocate. And when we were preparing to bring the second sort of portion of evidence before the grand jury to try to obtain a superseding indictment, so an indictment that could both capture all of Dr. Lee's criminal conduct and absorb the previous indictment, my boss, Bridget Brennan, assigned Peter to be the senior trial counsel. While I had been practicing law for a number of years, I'd done a couple of trials. Peter had done dozens of trials, and also, key point, I had never prosecuted a homicide. And this wasn't just one homicide case, it was a double homicide. So I was delighted to have Peter come on. However, Peter and I had very, very different work styles. He is more of the messy genius style. I am more of the, you know, compulsively neat and organized and sort of, you know, obsessive about thoroughness. Where one of Peter's skills, which is born of his experience, is that he knows exactly what he needs to get, and he doesn't worry about all the things that he might be able to get but doesn't really need. So our partnership was a little bit fraught, but ultimately what really brought us together with Joe in, you know, a very, very tight commitment to this case was that we had never seen anything like it. And, you know, it doesn't say much for me just because I hadn't, you know, I'd only been practicing law for a few years, but Joe and Peter together had decades of experience working on the most horrific crimes of the city, and neither of them could get over the cruelty of this case. And also just the death count. It was staggering.
Now, in your investigation, of course, and you showcase this in the book as well, you go back and forth to these real examples of the damage and the end result of overdose. Tell us about who you first meet in terms of Margaret Rappold or Joseph Haig's family. Which do you find do you locate first and speak to them, and what do they have to say to you about Vincent Lee, or pardon me, Stanley?
We first identified Nicholas Rappold as an overdose victim, and Joe began reaching out to Margaret, but he knew that it would take time. I can't remember which one we spoke to first, but it is possible that we made contact first with Margaret, but it's possible that we first spoke to members of the Haig family, because Joseph Haig's father was also a former NYPD detective. And so I believe he was, you know, more understanding of what the process might involve and more willing to speak to, or, you know, it's not that Margaret was unwilling, but I think for Joseph Haig's father, he was able to set aside his grief because he felt that he had a sense of duty to collaborate with us, whereas Margaret really, really just wasn't strong enough yet to talk about it. And we had to respect that. There finally came a moment when she was ready to talk. We sent Joe and Buddy LaSala to speak with her a couple times at her house. And then when she felt ready, I met with her along with Joe and Buddy in the principal's office of the school where she worked, the special education school where she worked. And, you know, that interview is really burnt into my mind for a number of reasons. I'd worked on appeals, I'd worked on narcotics cases, I'd never worked on a homicide. I was so nervous at the thought of saying the wrong thing, and not just to a mother who was grieving, but saying the wrong thing such that I would, you know, jeopardize the case in some way. Also, at the time, I had two young kids. I was in the middle of a divorce. For a variety of personal reasons, I had this sort of extreme sensitivity to the idea of anybody losing their child. And, you know, and so she, in my mind, she was somebody who had survived the worst. It was still very, very fresh for her. Nicholas had been dead, I think, just over a year, if that. And he died alone. He died alone in his car overnight. He was even issued a parking ticket while he was in the car, deceased. So there was really a sort of cruelty and loneliness to his death that was very hard for all of us to accept. And Margaret, you know, from our very first meeting, she said he was no angel. She wasn't out there to get anyone. She just wanted to know what happened. And she just had a sense that it wasn't just an accident, you know, because at the time, and again, we've evolved from this, but overdoses were simply classified as accidents and, you know, they became statistics. Now, because we had started with Dr. Lee and worked our way towards Nicholas's death, we were able to look at it from a different angle, but it became really a moral imperative for us to never again assume that these overdose deaths were just accidents. You know, and of course we can't trace back all of them. And in some cases, you know, the responsibility isn't the same as it is in this case, where you had a licensed physician who was not a drug user himself, who was driven by greed. But it's really important, I think, to see these deaths as untimely, unnecessary, and worthy of investigation.
Certainly. Let's use it as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, you talked about that certainly you regarded this in your office as a prosecutable crimes and homicide, potential convictions, also reckless endangerment. And so there is at least five or if I'm not correct, five people that you're dealing with in terms of charges. Tell us more about the trial, which begins in 2014.
We actually identified 20 patients out of more than 1,000 for whom we could bring charges against Dr. Lee. And the way that we did that was after the search warrant, we literally sat down in a conference room with, I think it was 1,200 patient files, and went through them one by one, and then cross-referenced against prescription records, medical records, records from other medical offices, interviews with family members, interviews with the individual if we could. We really, any time that we saw something that could potentially be connected to criminal conduct, we ran it down. So we ultimately winnowed it down to 20 patients where we felt that we could prove to a jury that Dr. Lee not only had sold prescriptions not in good faith, but in many of those cases had recklessly endangered the life of those patients, or had committed insurance fraud with respect to those patients. We also discovered, of course, that he was exploiting Medicare patients by promising to pay them back, forcing them to pay cash up front, and then, of course, keeping all of the money. So the trial was an event that we dreaded, that we feared, because we knew that it would be massive. I realize that I may be saying something that prosecutors don't usually say, but, I think anybody who says that they're not nervous about a trial is probably not telling the whole truth, because, there is such a high pressure, not just because, and actually not because you want to win, but because you want to get it right. And, we felt a tremendous pressure to do everything absolutely to the T, because there had never been a case like this before where a doctor was being tried on charges of homicide for the overdose death of a patient. We also, with 20 patients, that just meant hundreds of pieces of evidence. We had 72 witnesses lined up, many of whom didn't necessarily have a stable home or place of employment. So it was sort of a daily, we would wake up every day and wonder, will our witnesses be able to come in? How will they come in? How will the day unfold? You can't necessarily present evidence to the jury in a most linear fashion, because you have to respect people's schedules. And it was a roller coaster. It was in many ways a tremendous civics lesson, because we would have physicians and, other professionals coming in who had very, very difficult, demanding jobs, but who felt so strongly about doing their part and showing up. We had former patients of Dr. Lee who had criminal convictions on their record, or who had to come in and tell the jury that they had lied to Dr. Lee, and they were willing to come in and stand up. So it was extraordinary. And, there were also very difficult days where cross-examination would push witnesses to, deep levels of upset. One woman collapsed on the stand because she was so devastated by cross-examination. So those were four very, very long months. And what got us through was the teamwork, not just that we felt at the core level of me, Peter, Joe, but the team of experts and attorneys from our office and other offices, and the witnesses who were determined, no matter how hard it was, to, and no matter whether we got a conviction, because of course there's no certainty, but they wanted the truth to be known. And that is the beauty of a trial, is that whether you win or lose, the facts are out there and they are tested.
You said also that it would end up being likely a battle of the expert witnesses, and so you both had adequate expert witnesses to testify. The main crux of this, though, was that you had to prove these two homicide charges. Again, this is unprecedented, so you need to prove that. How did you use the stories, and what were the stories of Margaret Rappold and Joseph Haig that demonstrated clearly the homicide charges that you were trying to prosecute?
That's an excellent, excellent question, because it really gets to the tension in both the case and the trial. Dr. Lee made a very smart move in retaining an attorney who was actually a medical malpractice specialist. And so they shifted the ground of debate at trial away from, you know, the burden of proof on the charges and more towards what is medicine, what is a doctor's role, who is responsible when a patient defies a doctor's orders. And, you know, we had to prove, in order to satisfy the burden on the charge of an illegal sale of a prescription, we had to prove that the doctor was acting other than in good faith. And there was a very, very little case precedent in New York State to explain what that meant. We had a couple of factors from, you know, a case that was not binding on our court that indicated that, you know, there were certain behaviors like seeing large numbers of patients, accepting only cash, having sort of cookie cutter prescriptions that were the same for every patient. So we relied on those factors, but the defense attorney, Mr. Belair, and Dr. Lee really leaned heavily into the notion of not only a physician's discretion, but a physician's reliance on the patient and trust in the patient. And their argument was really that Dr. Lee had been betrayed by his patients. Now, you know, we did two things to counter that. First, we built a very, very strong case about the money. We followed the money and we proved to the jury that all of the decisions that were so-called medical decisions for Dr. Lee were actually about money. For instance, Dr. Lee claimed that he was very sensitive to the fact that his patients should not see other doctors or obtain controlled substances from other doctors. But we proved to the jury, using Dr. Lee's own medical records, that he was actually monetizing that fact. So you asked earlier about what made these records unusual, if anything. I don't know if you have ever had a doctor who noted in the margins of your medical records the amount of money that you were paying him or her on that visit, an amount of money in cash, and maybe with an, right? Or, you know, extra $50 for seeing another doctor, extra $50 for coming too early. That's what we found in the records, and that's what we were able to confront Dr. Lee with at trial. So, you know, that really countered his sort of medical defense. Now, on the recklessness, reckless homicide, which is manslaughter, the standard there is that you have to be aware of a substantial risk and then consciously disregard that risk. Now, before we even get to proving it, there was the debate about whether that was the appropriate charge, because there's another homicide charge that we considered, which is criminally negligent homicide. The difficulty is that with criminally negligent homicide, you know, it's Dr. Lee had too much knowledge. He was not just a trained and licensed physician, but he was a very good physician. He was also an anesthesiologist. So this was a man who walked that line between life and death, you know, every day at work, who knew how to put patients in a state of unconsciousness and bring them back, you know, who also had this X registration, which meant that he was also aware of opioid use disorder. So criminally negligent homicide just didn't fit the facts. Right. Whereas reckless manslaughter for Dr. Lee really captured his conduct. And what, in response specifically to your question about Joseph Haig and Nicholas Rappold, the clincher was that he had been put on notice, not just with them, but through his treatment of other patients, that there was a substantial risk that they weren't just going to take more than prescribed, but that they might die. So the way that we proved that was that we were able to marshal the medical records from all 20 of these patients and build a timeline for the jury where they saw that for up to 3 years before Dr. Lee even met Nicholas Rappold, he knew that he had patients who were taking more than prescribed, who were trading the pills for other drugs, who were overdosing, fatally and non-fatally, that those patients tended to be young. They tended to be male. They tended to have, you know, no diagnostic records, et cetera, et cetera. So by the time Nicholas Rappold walked into his office, Dr. Lee should have known. And in fact, he did know. The other, you know, one of the key pieces of evidence was a handwritten log or a set of handwritten logs that Dr. Lee's staff kept for every day of his practice, where you could see not just how many patients he saw per day, but what he charged them. And there, I remember we confronted him with one of those logs. He had seen 61 patients in a day, which was, you know, rather low for him. He would go up to 100. One of the first patients he saw was a patient whose father had written to him begging him to stop prescribing a couple of years earlier. She was there. This was in 2010. Then there was, you know, another patient who had later died of an overdose. There was Joseph Haig. And then there was Nicholas Rappold. And I, if I remember correctly, Nicholas Rappold was number 61 out of 61 patients. So you have this circumstantial evidence that, you know, how much attention would he have paid to this 21-year-old man after having seen 60 other patients in the course of just a regular, you know, a regular length workday. And the patients, you know, also were taking the stand and saying these visits lasted only as long as it took for him to write the prescription and take the money. So it really allowed the jury to understand what recklessness meant. That was recklessness. Recklessness was, you know, knowing the risk and disregarding it. Recklessness was seeing 61 patients in a day and then just writing a prescription to number 61 and sending him off, even though, you know, you knew that he might well take more or overdose. And I have to say, you know, even talking about it, it was devastating to work on, and it was very hard for the jury as well.
What's interesting is you also outlined the five rules that Peter Koghazian, this very experienced attorney, 35 years, he had five rules for cross-examination. And Dr. Lee, it's very interesting, he took the stand, but he'd have to answer some of these questions. I think it would be advised where it normally wouldn't be in criminal cases. So he started this cross-examination with a definite strategy from all his years of experience. And you outlined those five rules that he uses and used in this case to be able to get Dr. Lee to admit to certain lies. As you write, rules like Rule 4, break down conclusions. Have the defendant deny established evidence in the case. Isolate those parts of the defense story that are implausible and untruthful. So he had an incredible strategy to be able to, over the course of this is a long testimony. He was on the stand for days, wasn't he?
He really was. It was extremely long. So Peter, you know, over the course of his long career, had met many attorneys, and he in fact had trained many ADAs, including me. Tom DeMacis was one of the ADAs who'd had the greatest influence over Peter, and Peter tended to quote him very, very frequently. And there were in fact five rules. Rule number one for cross-examination was actually also one that I would say was Peter's rule number one in life, and that is always lead. So always lead means that you're always asking leading questions on cross-examination. You're not asking open-ended questions. And that's something that Peter did very, very strictly and skillfully for the first several hours of the cross-examination, and in fact, most of it, which was he would build questions that moved along in very small increments and obtain Dr. Lee's confirmation of those points. To, you know, to the point where you you could see the conclusion coming and there was no escaping it. For instance, you know, he would ask Dr. Lee about, you know, the payments that he received and the fact that he charged, you know, it was $150 as a baseline for a visit. And then there were extra $50 for this, seeing extra, you know, seeing other physicians, wanting more pills. And, you know, on such and such days, you saw X number of people, so that makes X. And then you made a, you know, your wife made a bank deposit of $7,000 or so in cash. And so Dr. Lee couldn't deny any one of those individual facts, but the conclusion was so much larger than just the sum of those responses. And, you know, Peter really did he was obsessive in preparing the cross-examination. He was obviously in a state of extreme stress. He lost, I would say, 20 to 30 pounds during the trial, which only later we learned was really the precursor to his illness. We thought that it was just the stress of trial, but it wasn't. And, you know, he was at the height of his powers, his, you know, advocacy powers. He really poured absolutely everything that he had into preparing this cross-examination. In fact, his office, which was always sort of a, you know, unnavigable cavern of piles of papers and books about magic and old shoes, was absolutely, I mean, you couldn't even get into it. You know, and he came for the cross-examination with piles and piles of paper. And so he had this sort of Columbo-like style. But just like Columbo, he knew exactly where he was going, and there was no escape. And I'm sorry, I realize I may have digressed a little bit from your question, but it's obviously very important to me, you know, especially knowing Peter's condition now, to really honor his work and talk about it and describe, you know, how much it takes to prepare for a case like this and also execute it.
You also talk, and I found it interesting for an attorney to say the kinds of things you were said, but it was still measured, but still critical. You talked about yourself, and you talked about Peter, and you also talked about Blair, the defense attorney. You said that you described it as you were both, all of you, were in the legal universe. However, there was a different spirit to Peter and yourself as opposed to Blair. Can you explain that?
Sure. So in that courtroom, think of it as, you know, there's a play within a play within a play. There's a, you know, you are in a court of law. It is a sacred space with rules, with its own, you know, codes and language. So a way that you're supposed to behave, areas where certain people can enter and others not. So you know, already as an attorney, you become sort of privy to that landscape and the significance of each area within the courtroom. That being said, as a more junior attorney, you're less familiar with it. You're more reliant on the court officers or the court staff or your own, you know, your own team to help orient you. And that's not always something that happens very smoothly. Sometimes I think we let young attorneys fumble around a bit more as almost part of a, you know, unconscious sort of hazing ritual. So as between Peter and Mr. Belair, I was, even though I'd been practicing law for, you know, 7 years or so at the time, I was the absolute rookie. I'm also a woman. I'm also, you know, on the small side. I don't think I have the deepest or most authoritative voice. And, you know, there were all sorts of perceptions and hierarchies at play that made it possible for Peter to, you know, be treated with the respect that he deserved because he had been an outstanding assistant district attorney and member of the Bar Association for many years. He was well known in the legal community. But for me to become a bit, I think, at times a bit of a scapegoat, and, you know, and also legitimately there, I was, you know, we're all still learning all the time. I was definitely learning a lot, and I had a sense of wanting to do everything really to a point of absolute completion and clarity that was maybe not necessary, or maybe more work than the court needed to do at the time. So I think between the age dynamics, the gender dynamics, the differences in experience levels, there were tensions often, and it was clear that sometimes if Peter could bring up a point, it would have more traction than if I brought it up. But Peter really taught me how to stand my ground. He was very, very respectful of our... We had a very clear agreement about who would do what, and we stuck to it. And interestingly, when I say a play within a play, I say that because you have the jury watching, and they are outsiders. And then you have the members of the audience, and then you have possibly the defendant's family, right, or the victim's family. So the jury noticed some of these dynamics, and in fact, at the end of the trial, members of the jury told Joe Hall that they had noticed some of the dynamics between the attorneys, and members of the judge's staff told me that they had felt badly for me during the trial, which I thought was, sweet to say, but also bittersweet, because, I think I realize that it's bizarre for a lawyer to say this, as you mentioned, but, you sometimes really feel like the crazy person in the room. And as it turns out, it's just that things may not be done that way, but it doesn't mean that you're wrong, and it certainly doesn't mean that you're out of line.
Right. You also talk about this potential of order of dismissal that Blair moves for at this end of this very, very long trial. Tell us about the verdicts. Tell us about the trepidation before the verdicts and the deliberation. Tell us about this.
That trepidation, I would say, began the day we arraigned Dr. Lee on the first indictment, November 2011, and only built from then on, because we knew that this was a very, very unusual case. And, I think part of our obsessional work for me and Peter and Joe and Stephanie was that we wanted to make sure that we were double-checking, triple-checking everything, that we weren't missing something or misunderstanding or misrepresenting because of this possibility that at any moment the rug might get pulled from under our feet. So, when the judge found at the close of our case that there was, there were sufficient reason to go forward, that was a tremendous relief. But of course, it only meant that you were moving on to another, even more uncertain phase of the trial, which was, first, would there be a defense? And second, what would that defense consist of? We had no idea. And in fact, Mr. Belair, who was a very, zealous advocate, as he was his job to do, refused to disclose the name of his medical expert until the moment that person took the stand. Under criminal procedure law, he should have turned over the name of the expert with his discovery when he turned over the expert's report. He refused to do so and was, in fact, held in contempt by the judge. We didn't know what would happen. Ultimately, Mr. Belair did decide to present a defense, and he called Dr. Lee to the stand. And then, my goodness, the tension in the room, you could have grabbed it and, twisted it. It was, we didn't know what he would say. And every sentence he uttered was a surprise. We had been waiting years to understand why, how could he have seen, Tracy Howard as her name is in the book, come in.
Mm-hmm.
How could he have heard her tell him about her father's suicide, heard her tell him that she wanted to commit suicide with his pills, and then let her walk out? And so to hear him address each of those patients, you know, we hung on every word, and it was unfortunately never, there was never a moment of relief or understanding, because until the very end, Dr. Lee denied responsibility, claimed that he had been acting in good faith, that he had been betrayed by his patients. And I'm not sure if you're aware, but we learned just a few weeks ago that he died in April in prison of COVID, which, you know, was very upsetting because he was not sentenced to death. Justice was not served by his, you know, lonely and isolated and what must have been a very frightening death. And, you know, we will never know the answers to many questions. And Margaret Rappold and others from the case, and I and Peter all agree that nobody deserves to die like that.
No. Tell us about the verdicts and tell us about the sentencing.
So the grand jury indicted Dr. Lee on 218 counts, of which 211 were taken to trial. Now, those counts included the two manslaughter counts, so for Joseph Hagen, Nicholas Rappold, three counts of reckless endangerment in the second degree for Michael Cornetta and two other patients. And it also included three counts of reckless endangerment in the first degree. Now, everybody talks about the homicide counts, and they are absolutely significant. But I have to say that for me, the three counts of reckless endangerment in the first degree were extremely significant because the standard there is depraved indifference to human life. Anybody who is familiar with New York state law or who has watched a few seminal episodes of Law and Order will know that depraved indifference is extremely hard to prove. And the jury found sufficient evidence of depraved indifference to human life in the case that we presented. And that was a source of tremendous, you know, validation, I think, for the families, you know, to know that their loved one had in fact deserved to be treated and viewed as a human being, and that their suffering had called for a different treatment. So those three counts were very significant, and they were upheld on appeal, which was, I think, the biggest surprise of all when the case went to the Court of Appeals. And then there were, for all of the, for each of the patients, the 20 patients, there were a series of charges of criminal sale for prescription, criminal sale of a prescription for a controlled substance. So we actually had presented evidence to the grand jury for every prescription that we believed had been made not in good faith in exchange for cash, so not for a medical reason. We asked the jury to indict Dr. Lee on that charge, and they did. And so you had this, think of it as sort of the foundation of the case, where all of these charges, and I believe there were more than 100 of them, that really formed the structure of the case. And then you had sort of towers where on one side you would build from those to reckless endangerment, another side you would build homicide, and then surrounding it we had the financial crimes, which included a scheme to defraud. So that captured all of the insurance fraud conduct and the financial exploitation of the Medicare patients. And it also included or was associated with Dr. Lee's falsification of records. So he was also under investigation by the Professional Oversight Agency in New York, but he had been submitting altered records to them. And so we used that evidence to undermine his credibility as well, and to show that, you know, his denials of the insurance fraud, you know, that the jury should not credit those. So those were sort of tied together in our mind. All in all, he was convicted on 198 out of 211 counts.
Yes. It's also amazing that his own record keeping and his own arrogant behavior, believing he would, that ignoring warnings from professionals, that he was really instrumental, especially with his own testimony, in his own conviction.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Very satisfying. In the end here, when you decided to write this book, you talked about your partner in this, Peter Koghuzian, and him being in the hospital and this manuscript. Can you just share that with us?
Yes. So Peter was diagnosed with ALS a few years after the trial, progressively lost his ability to speak, to move, even to breathe independently. And he was hospitalized in Manhattan. I think probably about 2 years ago. And so I was able then, and you know, at the time I thought that this was something that I would be able to do for a much longer time to come. Who knew about COVID, of course. So when the manuscript was almost ready, I would go to the hospital and stay, you know, anywhere from 1 to 4 hours and read the book to him. And it was, you know, it was terrifying in a way, because I knew that I had to talk. I had the hope of writing a book that sort of lifted the curtain on what it's really like, how messy life really is. How do you build a team when none of you are perfect? And when, you know, especially me, I didn't really know how to work within a team. So how do you do all those things? So I wanted to tell the truth. And at the same time, my relationship with Peter had really evolved to the point where not only, you know, had my respect for him grown tremendously, but we were friends. He was my mentor. He was my inspiration in a lot of ways. I still teased him about how messy he was, and there were things, you know, where we still rankled each other, but we were friends. And the last thing I wanted to do was hurt my friend, especially because he was not in a position to respond with his quick wit the way that he would have before. So there was this, you know, this strange series of events where every time I went in knowing that I had pages to read that were about him, and I would be so nervous. And then, you know, I would show up and one day his best friend was already there and asked me to read in front of him. The other day it was his priest, you know, so, or his son one day when I was about to read an especially difficult passage. And I told myself, you know, if I can't put in a book what I would not be willing to read to, obviously to Peter, but also to his priest. And at the same time, I wanted to tell the truth. So that, you know, I learned a lot about writing, in the sense that I learned how to, you know, how to edit so that you get to the point. And obviously I had tremendous help from my editor, Jessica Dulong, and Julia Heifetz, who reread the book and helped me to find really the true words to sort of try to capture that, you know, that ambivalence that we have, and that the fact that a friendship can be many, many different things, and that each of us is, you know, operates in many ways that don't always make sense, really trying to communicate the love and the affection and the respect that I had for every member of the team. So it was an unforgettable experience. Also, because being in a room with Peter, who at the time was already paralyzed, unable to speak or breathe on his own, someone whom I had seen in court, you know, marshaling very complex evidence, managing very, very difficult logistics, you know, responding on his feet at the drop of a hat to the most, you know, complicated legal arguments. And to be in a room where really the only thing we could do was just sit there and keep each other company and, you know, make him feel the presence of our friendship. And that, you know, working with him on the trial and subsequently being able to spend that time with him has had a tremendous impact on me.
Yes. I want to congratulate you for you and Peter and your team's incredible prosecution of Dr. Lee. There's so much more to this book that we won't have time to go into, and you do an incredible job of showing the real personal impact that a doctor like this and the Big Pharma has created in not only the U.S. but other countries as well. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about bad medicine, catching New York's deadliest pill pusher. Thank you so much, Charlotte Bismuth. Is there a Facebook page or a website that we might take a look at? And when does this book officially going to be released?
Thank you very much for having me, Dan, first of all. And I apologize for the background noise of puppy and toddler. The book comes out on January 19th. And I would love your listeners to know that I'm donating a portion of my proceeds to FedUp, which is a coalition of groups from around the country founded by parents who've lost their children to overdoses. And I'm working with them now, and I hope to make donations as a result of the book. So I thank everybody for their support. And the book should be on sale online and in every, you know, hopefully in your local bookstore that really needs our support.
Right. Thank you so much. Charlotte Bismuth, Bad Medicine, Catching New York's Deadliest Pill Pusher. Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.